The head porter had all their luggage piled at the hotel entrance, and Roland was settling their bill. Janine waited for him under the portico. Suddenly she started as she recognised the battered old open Land Rover that swung in through the gates and parked in one of the open slots at the end of the lot. Her first reaction, as she watched the familiar gawky figure untangle his long legs and flick the hair out of his eyes as he climbed out, was quick anger. "He's coming on purpose," she thought, "just to try and spoil it all." Craig came ambling towards her with his hands thrust into his pockets, but when he was less than a dozen paces from where she stood, he recognised her, and his confusion was obvious and unfeigned. "Jan!" he blushed furiously. "Oh, my God, I didn't know you'd be here." She felt her anger recede. "Hello, Craig, dear. No, it was a secret until now. I'm so dreadfully sorry." "Don't be. We're leaving anyway."
"Sonny boy."
Roland came out of the doorway behind Janine and went to throw a brotherly arm around Craig's shoulders. "You're ahead of me. How are you?"
"You knew I was coming."
Craig looked even more confused.
"I knew," Roland admitted, "but not so soon. You were supposed to report on the 28th. George gave me a couple of days off."
Since that first startled exchange, Craig had not looked at Janine again.
"I thought I'd spend them here." "Good boy, you'll need the rest. You and I are going to be doing a bit of work together. I tell you what, Sonny, let's have a quick drink. I'll explain it to you, some of it anyway."
"Oh, darling," Janine cut in swiftly, "we don't have time. I'll miss the flight." She could not bear the hurt and confusion in Craig's eyes another moment.
"Oh, damn it, I suppose you're right."
Roland checked his watch.
"It'll have to keep until I see you the day after tomorrow, Sonny."
And at that moment the Airways bus drove into the hotel driveway. Roland and Janine were the only passengers in the minibus out to the airport. "Darling, when will I see you again?"
"Look, I can't say for sure, Bugsy. That depends on so many things."
"Well, will you telephone me, or write, even?"
"You know I can't."
"I know, but I'll be at the flat, just in case."
"I wish you'd go out to live at Queen's Lynn. That's where you belong now."
"But my job."
"Oh, the hell with your job. Ballantine wives don't work."
"Well, see here, Colonel, sir. This Ballantine wife is going on working until..."
"Until?"
he asked. "Until you give me something better to do."
"Like what?"
"Like a baby."
"Is that a challenge?"
"Oh, please, Colonel, sir, do take it as one." At the airport, there was a cheerfully rowdy young crowd, all the men in uniform, come to see the aircraft leave. Most of them knew Roland, and they plied him and Janine with drinks. It made the last minutes more bearable. Then suddenly they were standing at the gate, and the air hostess was calling for boarding.
"I shall miss you so," Janine whispered. "I shall pray for you."
He kissed her, and held her so fiercely that she almost lost her breath.
"I love you," Roland said.
"You never said that before."
"No," he agreed. "Not to anybody before. Now go, woman, before I do something stupid."
She was the last in the straggling line of passengers that climbed the boarding ladder into the elderly Viscount aircraft parked on the hard stand. She wore a white blouse with a daffodil yellow skirt and flat sandals. There was a matching yellow scarf around her hair and a sling bag over her shoulder. In the doorway of the aircraft at the top of the boarding ladder, she looked back, shading her eyes as she searched for Roland, and when she found him, she smiled and waved and then stepped through the fuselage door. The door closed, and the boarding ladder wheeled away. The Rolls-Royce Dart turboprop engines whined and fired, and the silver Viscount with the flying Zimbabwe bird emblem on its tail taxied downwind to its holding point. Cleared for takeoff, it lumbered back down the runway and climbed slowly into the air. Roland watched it bank onto its southerly heading for Bulawayo, and then went back into the airport building, showed his pass to the guard at the door, and climbed the steps to the control tower.
"What can we do for you, Colonel?"
the assistant controller at the flight planning desk greeted him.
I'm expecting a helicopter flight coming in from Wanky to pick me up."
"Oh, you are Colonel Ballantyne. Yes, we've got your bird on the plot. They were airborne 12 minutes ago. They'll be here in about an hour and 10 minutes." While they were talking, the The flight controller at the picture windows was speaking quietly with the pilot of the departing Viscount.
"You are cleared to standard departure, unrestricted climb 15,000 feet, over now to Bulawayo approach on 118.6. Good day."
"Understand standard departure, unrestricted climb to flight le..." The pilot's calm, almost bored voice broke off, and the sideband hummed for a few seconds. Then the voice came back, crackling with urgency. Roland spun away from the flight planning desk and strode to the controller's console. He gripped the back of the controller's chair and through the tall windows stared up into the sky. The high, fair-weather clouds were already turning pink with the oncoming sunset, but the Viscount was out of sight, somewhere out there in the south. Roland's face was hard and terrible with anger and fear as he listened to the pilot's voice grating out of the radio speakers. The portable surface-to-air missile launcher, designated SAM-7, is a crude-looking weapon almost indistinguishable from the bazooka anti-tank rocket launcher of the World War II. It looks like a 5-foot section of ordinary drainpipe, but the exhaust end is slightly flared into the mouth of a funnel. At the point of balance, there is a shoulder plate below the barrel and an aiming and igniting device like a small portable AM radio set attached to the upper surface of the barrel. The weapon is operated by two men. The loader simply places the missile in the exhaust breech of the barrel, and making sure the fins engage the slots, pushes it forward until its rim engages the electrical terminals and locks it into the firing position. The missile weighs little less than 10 kilos. It has the conventional rocket shape, but in the front of the nose cone is an opaque glass eye, behind which is located the infrared sensor. The tail fins are steerable, enabling the rocket to lock onto and follow a moving target. The gunner settles the barrel across his shoulder, places the earphones on his head, and switches on the power pack. In the earphones, he hears the cyclic tone of his audio warning. He tunes this down below the background infrared count so that it is no longer audible. The weapon is now loaded and ready to fire. The gunner searches out his target through the cross-hatched gun sight. As soon as an infrared source is detected by the missile sensor, the audio warning begins to sound, and a tiny red bulb lights up in the eyepiece of the gun sight to confirm that the missile is locked on. It remains only for the gunner to press the trigger in the pistol-type grip, and the missile launches itself in relentless pursuit of its prey, steering itself to track it accurately through any turns or changes of altitude. Tungata Zabiwe had held his Kada in position for 4 days. Apart from himself, there were 8 of them, and he had chosen each of them with extreme care. They were all veterans of proven courage and determination, but more importantly, they were all of superior intelligence and capable of operating under their own initiative. Every one of them had been trained in the use of the SAM-7 missile launcher, in both roles of loader and gunner, and each of them carried one of the finned missiles in addition to their AK-47 assault rifles and the usual complement of grenades and AP mines. Any two of them could make the attack, and had been thoroughly briefed to do so. The wind direction would dictate the departure track of any aircraft leaving the main runway of Victoria Falls Airport. Wind velocity would also affect the aircraft's altitude as it passed over any specific point on the extended centre line and crosswind legs of its outward track. Fortunately for Tungata's calculations, the prevailing northeasterly wind had been blowing at a steady 15 knots during the entire 4 days in which they had been in position. He had chosen a small kopje, thickly wooded enough to give them good cover, but not so thick that it impeded the view over the surrounding treetops. From the peak in the early mornings, before the heat haze and dust thickened, Tungata had been able to see the stationary silver cloud of spray that marked the Victoria Falls on the northern horizon. Each afternoon, they had practiced the attack drill. Half an hour before the expected time of departure of the scheduled Viscount flight from Victoria Falls to Bulawayo, Tungata had moved them into position, 6 men in a ring below the summit to guard against surprise attack by security forces, and 3 men above them in the actual attack group. Tungata himself was the gunner, and his loader and backup loader had both been chosen for the acuteness of their hearing and the sharpness of their eyesight. On each of the three preceding afternoon drills, they had been able to hear the turboprop Rolls-Royce Dart engines minutes after takeoff. They were in climb power setting, and the whine was distinctive. It drew the eye to the tiny crucifix shape of the aircraft against the blue. On the first afternoon, the Viscount had climbed almost directly over their copy, at not more than 8,000 feet in altitude, and Tangata had locked on and tracked it until it passed out of sight and then out of hearing. The second afternoon, the aircraft had passed at about the same altitude, but 5 miles to the east of their position. That was extreme range for the missile. The audio signal had been weak and intermittent, and the lock-on bulb had glowed only fitfully. Tangata had to admit to himself that an attack would probably have failed. The third day, the Viscount had been east of them again, 3 miles out. It would have been a good kill, so that the odds seemed to be about 2-1 in their favour. This fourth day, he moved the attack team into position on the summit 15 minutes early, and tested the SAM launcher by aiming it at the lowering sun. It howled in his ears at the excitation of that immense infrared source. Tangata switched off the power pack, and they settled down to wait, all their faces lifted to the sky. His loader glanced at his wristwatch and murmured, "They are late." Tangata hissed at him viciously. He knew they were late, and already the doubts were crowding in. Flight delayed or cancelled, even a leak in their own security. The Kanka might already be on their way.
"Listen," said the loader.
And seconds later he heard it also, the faint whistling whine in the northern sky.
"Ready,"
he ordered, and settled the shoulder plate into position, and switched on the power pack. The audio warning had been preset, but he checked it again.
"Load,"
he said. He felt the missile go into the breech, and weighted the barrel slightly tail-heavy. He heard the clunk of the rim setting itself against the terminals.
"Loaded,"
his number two confirmed, and tapped his shoulder. He traversed left and right, making certain he was firmly settled, and his loader spoke again.
"Nancy! There!"
He extended his arm over Tungata's left shoulder and pointed upwards with his forefinger. Tungata searched, and then caught the high silver spark as the sunlight reflected off burnished metal.
"Target identified," he said,
and heard his two loaders move aside softly to avoid the back blast of the rocket. The tiny speck grew swiftly in size, and Tungata saw that it was tracking to pass less than half a mile to the west of the hillock, and that it was at least 1,000 feet lower than it had been on the preceding afternoons. It was in a perfect position for attack. He picked it up in the cross wires of the gun sight, and the missile howled lustfully in his earphones, a wicked sound like a wolf pack hunting at full noon. The missile had sensed the infrared burn from the exhausts of the Rolls-Royce engines. In the gun sight, the lock-on bulb burned like a fiery red cyclops eye, and Tangata pressed the trigger. There was a stunning whoosh of sound, but almost no recoil from the weapon across his shoulder as it exhausted through the funnel vent in the rear. He was enveloped for microseconds in white fumes and whirling dust. But when they were whipped away by their own velocity, he saw the little silver missile going upwards into the blue on the feather of its own rocket vapours. It was like a hunting falcon, baiting from the gloved fist, going up to tower above its quarry. Its speed was dazzling, so that it seemed to dwindle miraculously into nothingness, and there was only the faint drumming rumble of its rocket burn. Tangata knew that there was no time for a second launch. By the time they could reload, the Viscount would be well out of range. They stared up at the tiny, shiny aircraft, and the second seemed to flow with the slow viscosity of honey. Then there was a little flick of liquid silver that distorted the perfect cruciform of the aircraft's wing profile. It popped open like a ripe cotton pod, and the Viscount seemed to lurch and yaw, then steady again. Seconds later they heard the crack of the strike to confirm what they had seen, and a hoarse roar of triumph burst up out of Tungati Zabiwe's throat. As he watched, The Viscount banked into a gentle turn. Then abruptly something large and black detached itself from the port wing and fell away towards the earth. The aircraft dropped its nose sharply, and the engine noise rose into a shrill, wild whine.